From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 40 acres and a mule. That was the promise to newly freed slaves at the end of the Civil War. But following Abraham Lincoln's assassination, President Andrew Johnson reversed that order. The land went back to former Confederate owners, leaving many African Americans to struggle as sharecroppers. The question over what the United States owes the descendants of enslaved Black Americans has lingered ever since. Now, more than 150 years later, 2020 Democratic presidential hopefuls are drawing a line from slavery to racial inequality to today, renewing calls for reparations. But what would a policy to address the legacy of slavery actually look like? And after generations, what would reparations solve, or what problems might it create? This hour on Point, reparations for slavery and the 2020 election. And you can join us. What do you make of the proposals from the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates? Do you support the concept of reparations for slavery, or would it only exacerbate existing divides? Has the U.S. done enough to heal the moral wounds of slavery, or do you even challenge the notion that there is a debt to be repaid at all? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us first from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, is Erin Haynes-Wack, national writer on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press. She's covering the 2020 presidential election. Erin, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. First of all, start off by giving us sort of your broad impression about, are you surprised by how often the question of reparations has been coming up to Democratic presidential candidates this year so far?
Well, I have to say I am surprised that it is such a central part of this early 2020 conversation, because as you probably know, the issue really was more of a fringe topic for years. But it really entered the mainstream in 2014 with Ta-Nehisi Coates' essay in The Atlantic, mm-hmm. The Case for Reparations. Bernie Sanders was asked about reparations in 2016. And if we remember, President Obama was actually against reparations, so more from a pragmatic standpoint. But now you have several candidates that are signaling their support. But like you said, no specifics have really been offered by most of them.
Right. So it's quite a change in terms of how high profile Democrats are willing to engage with this question. I mean, let's listen to a little bit from just this week. This was a CNN town hall in Jackson, Mississippi on Monday. And Massachusetts Democratic senator and presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren endorsed a House bill to create a commission to study reparations for slavery.
Today in America, because of housing discrimination, because of employment discrimination, we live in a world where for the average white family has $100, the average Black family has about $5. So I believe it's time to start the national, full-blown conversation about reparations in this country.
Senator Elizabeth Warren at a CNN town hall in Jackson, Mississippi on Monday. Erin Haynes-Wack, I mean, Warren said, it's time to start a full-blown conversation about reparations in this country, which maybe that's exactly what's going on. But does that mean that we're hearing full-throated support for the idea of reparations from these candidates?
Well, we are hearing support, but again, it is really a question of what that support is going to translate into. And you mentioned House Bill 40, which Senator Warren has signaled her support for. And that bill has actually been proposed every year since 1987 in the U.S. House. It was long sponsored by former Congressman John Conyers of Michigan. And the bill's new sponsor is Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee out of Texas. Now, I recently spoke with her, and she has reintroduced this bill in this new Congress, which has a Democratic House majority, and is awaiting a judiciary hearing, a committee hearing on the issue. So we'll see where that goes. But there could also be, you know, for these senators who are running in 2020 and who have voiced their support for reparations, they could certainly sponsor a companion bill in the Senate, even though the Senate does not have a majority. But that would certainly be a way to signal their support. And, you know, even another potential avenue is for a new Democratic president to establish a study commission on reparations, not unlike the Kerner Commission report that was created by President Lyndon Johnson after the race riots that happened in urban centers during the late 1960s. So there are a few different ways to really get beyond just voicing support for this issue.
Okay. But on the other hand, I mean, if really what we're hearing candidates talk about is a support for a study commission, for example, I mean, is that just sort of playing politics to the base without really promising anything at all? And without saying, okay, well, if the study commission comes out with a particular set of definitions of the scope of the problem, here are the actual solutions or actions I might support.
Well, I think the experts that I've talked to about reparations, people who have long toiled on this issue, really do say that the solution really begins with a study that would determine the scale and the scope of the harm that was done to Black people during and after slavery. And that study could really inform how to remedy that harm. You know, we talk about systemic racism, which now, you know, the candidates are really rooting in slavery and everything that has come after that. But, you know, that systemic racism stretches across so many different areas of American life, from housing to education to wealth to, you know, the economy. Just the disparities can be traced back to slavery. And, you know, so reparations cannot necessarily mean just one particular area of American life, but it would take a study to really kind of figure out just how broad, you know, the injury has been to Black people in America.
Mm. Well, let's listen to what Senator Kamala Harris of California and also Democratic presidential hopeful has said about this. On the radio show The Breakfast Club last month, she agreed with the host of that show that reparations would help to address the legacy of slavery.
People aren't starting out on the same base in terms of their ability to succeed. And so we have got to recognize that and give people a lift up.
That's Senator Kamala Harris of California. Erin Haynes-Wack, tell us a little bit more about Harris's approach to this. Has she been more specific than what we just heard in terms of her support for reparations?
No, I wouldn't say more specific. What I would say is that people like Senator Harris, Senator Brooker also have certainly discussed policies that they feel could disproportionately benefit Black Americans. Senator Brooker, for example, has talked about baby bonds, which would, create money that would that children would get that could help them, you know, later in life. Or his marijuana bill, certainly we know about the marijuana disparities in our criminal justice system. And so policies that would disproportionately benefit Black Americans. But obviously, when we talk traditionally, when we have talked about reparations, what we are talking about are policies that specifically target African Americans. So a policy that would help African Americans or maybe even help them to an outsized degree is not necessarily the same as reparations,
right,
if that makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, so let's listen to one more presidential hopeful here. This is former U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Julian Castro telling MSNBC last month that if he were elected president, as we were talking about the task forces and the commission, that he would do just that. He would set up a task force to study reparations for slavery.
It is interesting to me that under our Constitution and otherwise, that we compensate people if we take their property. Shouldn't we compensate people if they were property sanctioned by the state? So I believe that is a conversation that's worth having. And I see that as right and wrong. I don't see that as political or non-political.
It's Julian Castro there. Erin Haynes-Wack, you know, Castro there making the point that he doesn't see this as a political or non-political question. But I do want to just sort of dwell in the politics of this moment with you for another minute or two here. For example, we have candidates, Democratic presidential candidates talking about this. I mean, how far is this embrace of the concept of reparations going across the Democratic Party? Like, will it be in the party platform, for example?
Well, that's certainly a good question and one that we should continue to pay attention to as 2020 continues. But nationally, I should mention, you know, the idea of reparations is still something that many Americans are opposed to. There was a 2016 poll that showed something like 68% of Americans said the country should not pay cash reparations to African Americans. And not surprisingly, those results broke down along racial lines, with something like 8 in 10 white Americans opposed to reparations and 6 in 10 blacks being in favor of reparations. So the country is still very divided on this issue. And so that may inform how politically appealing it is to the party as part of their national agenda.
Right. I mean, I see from your reporting here that DNC Chairman Tom Perez is kind of being he's equivocating on this, saying that it'll be discussed right during the course of the presidential nominating process. So how are Republicans, though, looking at the fact that Democrats are embracing the concept of reparations?
Well, Republicans that I've spoken to are saying, you know, that they welcome a conversation around reparations, possibly because they know how divisive it is. And just the idea that taking money, as some people see reparations as taking money away from white people and giving it to black people, will only exacerbate the racially divided political climate that we now find ourselves in. And so this certainly could emerge as a wedge issue in 2020, once we get to the general election, or maybe even before.
Well, and Aaron Haynes, Wack, we've got just a minute left here to go, and I wanted to underscore something you said a little earlier. How much or how significant the change is that this has become a central question amongst at least leading Democrats here, because as you pointed out, Barack Obama himself, when he first became president of the United States, was opposed to the idea. In his very Obama-esque way, he sort of turned to it towards the end of his presidency. So what does that tell you, though? Is it that Americans, at least some Americans, are more willing to engage in this conversation? Is it that attitudes about race have changed? What's sort of the underlying shift that's going on here?
Well, I think what we are talking about is, as more people are coming around to the notion of systemic, widespread racism in America, and the fact that that is institutionalized, you know, in many areas of our society, you know, the question is, how did we get there? And the answer certainly, you know, for most folks would be slavery. It is rooted in slavery. And so, you know, it is remarkable that, you know, as recently as 2003, you know, reparations was a joke in you know, Dave Chappelle's comedy skit. And now we are having serious conversations about the idea of reparations in a presidential election.
Well, Aaron Haynes Wack, national writer on race and ethnicity for the Associated Press, covering the 2020 presidential election. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Meghna. Have a great day.
You too. Well, when we come back, we'll hear from two folks about their views on reparation and whether or not it should go from concept to actual concrete reality and how that would be. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about reparations for slavery and how the concept has moved from the fringe of the political conversation in America to squarely in the middle of the conversation or the political conversation for at least Democratic presidential hopefuls in 2020. And we want to dig deeper beyond the politics into what we're talking about when we're talking about reparations for slavery. What would a reparations plan look like and whether or not it's truly needed today in 2019 in America. We got a lot of comments already coming in online here. On Facebook, Marguerite Martin says, it's about time. Reparations are the bare minimum. America was built by enslaved black people. White people need to educate themselves on the realities of what our wealth and access have been built on. None of this has ever been made right. Never. Whereas over on Twitter, IceFlame12 says, while it may be the right thing, it would undoubtedly stoke racial tensions. Many whites believe they are being forgotten and left behind. This change could affirm those beliefs and lead to more radicalization and harm. Well, joining us now from Durham, North Carolina, is William Darity, professor of public policy, African and African American studies, and economics at Duke University. He's also director of Duke's Samuel Dubois Cook Center on Social Equity and co-author of the forthcoming book, From Here to Eternity, Black Reparations in the 21st Century. Professor Darity, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me on. It's actually From Here to Equality.
From Here to Equality. Okay, so no beach scenes in your book.
No, none in ours.
my deepest apologies.
No,
I'm going to fix that right now. Okay. Well, okay. Also with us from New York is John McWhorter, professor of English and Comparative Literature at Columbia University, contributing editor to The Atlantic. He's written numerous arguments against reparations for slavery. We've got a link to his 2001 New Republic article on that. That link is at onpointradio.org. Professor McWhorter, welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
Okay, so Professor Darity, let me just first start with you. We'll sort of dig into what a plan for reparations might look like. But I just want to get your sense. Are you surprised by how much it's being discussed amongst Democratic presidential hopefuls this year?
Yes, I certainly didn't anticipate this. I think that there's a number of proposals and policies that are being considered this year that surprise me, including the baby bonds proposal that Aaron Hainswack mentioned, which has been largely developed from work that I've done with Derek Hamilton, who is currently at Ohio State. And that's a proposal to provide trust accounts to each newborn infant in the United States, a universal program. I've also worked on the idea of having a federal job guarantee, and that's on the table in terms of conversations right now. So I'm kind of surprised at the turn towards consideration of a set of bold policies that would really transform America.
Mm. So same question to you, Professor McWhorter. I mean, as Aaron Hainswack was saying in the previous segment, she sees it as sort of a broadening acknowledgement of the systemic effects of the legacy, the systemic legacy of slavery and racism in America, so that it perhaps, you know, it does make a little sense that reparation is being more vigorously and seriously discussed now. What do you think?
I don't get this, Meghna. I'm worried that I must be getting old. I'm only 53, but we're talking as if this is brand new. And it really isn't. And I don't mean that you can go back to 1973 to things that people don't read anymore. In the late 90s, and for a few years after the year 2000, this country was engaged in a vigorous debate about reparations. Randall Robinson's book, The Debt, was the big hit. Any aware black person in the country read it or pretended to. There was a big, big debate. And I hate to sound condescending, but I'm beginning to wonder whether maybe people about under 40 now just were too young then to realize it. This is not a time when America is suddenly waking up to this notion and having a conversation about it. We already had it, and reparations, frankly, was soundly defeated as a viable notion. And this was not just by ignorant white people who were tired of black people acting up. We talked about this. We talked about simple questions as to who counts as black. We talked about questions as to if you gave the money to organizations, which organizations would they be? And more to the point, what would the organizations do that we could know would have a significant effect as opposed to the sorts of things that have been tried in the past? And so, you know, nobody blew a horn, but it was clear by about 2002 that the conversation had been had, and that really it's not that nothing needs to be done, and we'll get to what needs to be done, to help black people and to make up for the very real sins of the past. But the idea that there would be something called reparations emblazoned in the sky and offered as a grand apology, it simply didn't work. And then all of a sudden in 2014, we were told that this was a brand new idea. And today, this way that the media is framing the discussion as if America is finally having a real discussion about this, it simply isn't true. We did this 20 years ago, and I think the discussion now is going to come out exactly the way it did then.
So let me just respond to that, because to me what seems different now, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but what seems different now is, yes, that discussion was had maybe almost a generation ago, as you point out. But now we have aspirants to the White House very, very enthusiastically supporting the notion of at least, you know, coming up with a commission to examine the modern day harms of the legacy of slavery. So the difference is it's become a politically viable discussion to have and not necessarily seen as something that is completely out of the realm of possibility. Does that not seem different to you, Professor McWhorter?
With all due respect, Meghna, no, I really don't see any difference. It was not considered out of the possibility of respectable discussion in the year 2000. Lots of very influential people were very seriously discussing it, not presidential candidates, because the culture certainly has changed and we have a welcomely leftist or even liberal slate of interesting Democratic candidates. All that is very welcome. But the issue really is, are people really talking about support for an idea of this kind, or is this really a kind of genuflection that ambitious people feel that they have to make, where the way today that you say that you're concerned about black people's plight and that you acknowledge the ills that were exerted upon black people in the past is to say something like, we need to talk about reparations. 15 years ago, what you said was, we need to have a conversation about race. And it was always clear that the conversation about race was really supposed to be a conversion where people were made to understand what black people go through. Mm. Now, the new way of saying that is to say, we need to have a conversation about a research proposal about reparations. I don't see anything proactively sincere in this, and I wish we would just get on with doing the things that we know really do help black people, whether or not they are labeled reparations with a capital R and are accompanied by some kind of concert.
Okay. So, Professor Darity, what do you think? I mean, do you see this as White House aspirants genuflecting?
It's a pretty courageous act of genuflecting, given the degree of opposition to reparations that that John McWhorter says we are confronted with. And I would say that there is not an enormous wellspring of support for reparations, but I think conditions have changed. In the early 1990s, about 4% of white Americans indicated that they would support a reparations program for black Americans. Today, a Marist poll that was conducted a couple of years ago indicates that it's closer to 20 to 25% of white Americans. And if you look at millennials, it's close to half of millennials who actually endorse a reparations program for black Americans. I think that the real issue is that what's unique about this particular moment is that we do, in fact, have a series of serious presidential candidates who are actually talking about this issue, that it's not verboten in the national conversation anymore. It used to be. Folks who talked about reparations in the early 1990s were confined largely to the black community. It was not a conversation
later,
that
Professor
was held on a national scope, and now that is the case. I'd also add that I think it's an act of courage on the part of some of the political candidates to come forward and say that they're in favor of reparations when a minority of Americans have indicated support for it. But I think it's an indication that these are folks who are willing to take on the true mantle of leadership and engage in advocacy and education for the purposes of putting us in a position to write a moral claim that has never been met in the United States and to address the need for a genuine national reckoning on the issue of racial injustice. And one other thing I'd like to add. This is not a question of compensation exclusively for the sins of slavery. I think what we really need to address in the context of a reparations program is the long and cumulative trajectory of racial injustice that has been delivered upon black American descendants of folks who were enslaved in the United States. This stretches from slavery to the present moment. And it includes the Jim Crow period of legal segregation, as well as ongoing dimensions of racism, which include the police killings of unarmed blacks, mass incarceration, and from my perspective as an economist, most particularly the enormous racial wealth gap that Senator Warren talked about in her remarks the other night.
Well, Professor McWhorter, I'm certain you want to respond to that, so go ahead.
Well, I would just say that I completely agree with Professor Darity that we cannot pretend that we need to only talk about slavery and then say, well, that was 400 years ago. No, it's slavery, it's Jim Crow, it's redlining, and you can expand it up into next week. But this is the crucial issue. Now, reparations, the idea is supposedly that America has never faced up to any of those things. But America did, and I'm just going to say very briefly, affirmative action in all of its manifestations is reparations. And if you say that it only affected white women, then why does everybody scream bloody murder the minute anybody tries to criticize affirmative action? It's been very good for black people. We all know it. Welfare expansion in the late 60s, a chapter that doesn't get told much, that was done for poor black Americans, and it put a whole lot more of black America on welfare, which had good and bad repercussions. The Community Reinvestment Act in the early 70s, it doesn't make for good reportage. It's kind of boring in itself, but that was aimed at improving inner city black communities. Talk about awareness raising. Don't forget that article the Times ran last week, where it turns out that woke white America is often woker than a lot of black people. That would have been unthinkable in the 1991 that Professor Darity refers to, or even 10 years ago. Things have happened. I'm not against reparations. My point is not, despite my snotty voice, that we just need to get over it. No, black people don't need to get over anything. It's that reparations started with the Great Society and beyond in the mid-60s. And very quickly, this is the point. If you say that those things didn't work well enough, who knows now what would work better? How you change these things, even if the injustice was in the past, even if the injustice is ineradicable and it's clear what created it, including the wealth gap. Who knows now what you could do other than great society type things that would work? And if we don't, then my question very simply is, what are we talking about? And that's why I say that this is a genuflection, and I don't think that genuflection in 2019 is brave. What was going to happen to Elizabeth Warren? Was a house going to fall on her? Was Tucker Carlson going to say something mean about her? She would have been just fine. It is just a genuflection that makes a white person sound like they care about black people, or a black candidate sound like they care about the people left behind. I don't see the point.
Professor Darity, I'm going to come back to you in just a second, but Professor McWhorter, to that question of who knows now what would work better, is that not exactly the aim of these commissions that are being proposed to study the true, get a better sense of the true extent of the harm done by the legacy of slavery and systemic racism for the past 250 years, so that better policies can be crafted?
It's a nice idea, but let's face it. Academics and policymakers for the past 55 or 60 years have basically been doing that study in extended form. And what really do we know creates that kind of magic? What exactly were we expecting this commission to come up with? Because if it would really sound kind of like Black Lives Matter has come up with a slate of about 9 policies that would supposedly help the black community. It's noble work. I understand it. It's not that there's anything wrong with it. But what it basically is what somebody would have come up with in about 1967. It's the Great Society over again. And the simple fact is that the Great Society programs really didn't make much difference. And if anybody doubts it, I urge you to study a book on Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn by Michael Wordsworth that gives a granular description of what the Great Society was like on the ground. And frankly, Bed-Stuy today has all sorts of problems. And so I understand the logic of all this, and if anything, the theater of all of it, and I do mean that word. But what really are we talking about? What would the commission find? What is it that we have somehow missed during all of this time that now a bunch of people would put their heads together and come up with something that's been just ignored for the past 50 years? We know nothing would happen. And so we need something that would really help poor black people be less poor. And I don't think that it's this. Frankly, and Professor Darity, I don't mean that your book and your work is somehow invalid, but I mean the way that we're talking about all this now, and frankly, these things these candidates are saying because they have to, it's performance art. It's not policy.
Professor Darity, I mean, he's given you a lot to respond to. Go ahead.
Well, that was inevitable that he would. So let me start by saying that in a previous case of reparations that was enacted in the United States, the reparations payments that were made to the Japanese American community after being subjected to incarceration, unjust incarceration during the course of World War II, the prelude to that reparations program was the formation of a commission, and it was called the Commission to Study and Develop it was called the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Citizens. And that commission was responsible for documenting the narrative, the sound and accurate narrative of the conditions that Japanese Americans were subjected to during the course of World War II, and to provide a design of proposals for restitution. And so I think as a prelude to the development of a comprehensive reparations program for Black Americans, it's appropriate to have a similar kind of commission, a commission to study and develop reparations proposals for African Americans of the sort that is embodied in the legislation, the House Resolution, legislation House Resolution 40. I think that commission would have a responsibility for also crafting a comprehensive narrative about the history of racial injustice. And in so doing, they could draw upon the research that has been developed not just over the course of the past 50 years, but over the course of the entire sweep of time from the end of the Civil War to the present moment. We have a phenomenal historical record that can be drawn upon to develop the case in full. One of the most important works would be W.E.B. Du Bois's Black Reconstruction in America.
Professor Darity, stand by here for just a second. I've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're talking about reparations and the discussion of it in 2019. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how the discussion over reparations for slavery has come into the center of the political conversation for 2020 Democratic presidential candidates and what that means about our national discussion of reparations or over reparations. I'm joined today by John McWhorter. He's a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, a contributing editor at The Atlantic as well. William Darity is also with us. He's a professor of public policy, African and African-American studies and economics at Duke University. And we're going to get to calls here in a second, but Professor Darity, there's actually something that Professor McWhorter said in the last segment that I wanted to hear from you on. And Professor McWhorter was making the point that the United States in the past has done things to meaningfully assist African-Americans. He talked about affirmative action, welfare expansion, the Great Society. And, you know, that there are many more things that could be done. And Professor McWhorter said, like, if the true goal is to meaningfully do things to assist African-Americans now and today, I'm wondering, Professor Darity, if you think that putting that all within the context of reparations, calling it reparations, actually makes it more difficult to get the policies passed that would assist African-Americans in the way that you believe is needed.
So let me make two comments. One of those comments is that the welfare expansion that was associated with the Great Society was a corrective for the exclusion of blacks from the social safety net that took place when the New Deal programs were inaugurated. So it was not a newly introduced social policy that suddenly was designed specifically for black Americans. It was a correction of a process of exclusion from the same set of services for close to 30 years or more. So that's one point I'd like to make. The second point I'd like to make is that the types of social programs that have been introduced that presumably will be of assistance to black Americans have focused on income. It's focused on income rather than wealth. And this is a critical distinction because it's the wealth disparity that is the most dramatic in terms of racial differences. Senator Warren's comment was something to the effect of the typical black American household has $5 for every $100 in net worth that's held by the typical white household. This is a disparity that is not tackled at all by affirmative action, welfare expansion, or the Community Reinvestment Act. And it's what I think needs to be the central focus of a reparations program. So if we want to talk about a central target of a reparations program, the objective should be to address the magnitude of the enormous racial wealth gap. And this cannot be accomplished by universal programs exclusively. And in fact, one of my complaints about the positions that have been taken by some of the candidates, most explicitly by Kamala Harris, is that it propagates a confusion between universal programs that address poverty and inequality for everyone and reparations for black Americans, which would be a program that would be particular to the long unmet claim for racial justice on the part of black American descendants of persons enslaved in the United States. I'm actually for both types of programs. I'm an enthusiast for universal programs that would address poverty and inequality for all Americans. But I also think it's imperative that we have a program of reparations that focuses specifically on the enormous racial wealth gap that that has been perpetrated since the failure to provide the formerly enslaved black folks in the United States with the 40 acres and a mule that they were promised. So I don't see the universal programs and a reparation program as being substitutes for one another. I don't see them as being mutually exclusive. If anything, they are complementary.
Okay. Well, so John McWhorter, let me turn to you here. But I guess what I was getting at is I hear and understand everything Professor Darity is saying, but I'm also – maybe this is just too narrow-minded of me. I'm thinking of the political feasibility of launching these programs when you say – when you even just – when you mention reparations, you get responses such as from – I'm seeing here from Republican strategist Whit Ayers, who says the idea that you resolve long-term racial inequities by taking money from white people and giving it to black people, it will make racial relations worse, not better. And Republicans would love to have that debate. I mean,
well, you know, to tell you the truth, if we could get something like this through and it made a lot of white people mad, well, that's just too bad. But the truth is, I don't understand here. I imagine you come from a distant nation. You've learned English recently and you're listening to the way we're talking about this sort of thing. So let's talk about the wealth business. And I think we need to use clear language instead of a tendency that I think all of us have to slip into a kind of a liturgical code. First of all, if we're talking about fixing the wealth gap specifically, who's black? We've been talking about that since 1973, and the answer is there's no way to determine which families are black and which aren't. There's so many fuzzy lines. That aside, which is part of why reparations never really gets off the ground, it's not just racism. It's that it's been too long. There's been too much mixture. But then second, and this is the most important thing, is the idea, is it that there are so many black families who lack any substantial wealth? And so what reparations would do is send those families, and I don't mean the word checks as disparagement, checks, but or some sort of money transfer, so that they automatically have as much wealth as the typical white family. Now, I don't know if we need to call it taking money from white people, but it's the idea that the government fills up Black America's check accounts so that they have this wealth. Because some people would say what we need to do is instruct and teach and make it easier for Black people to attain wealth through their own efforts. Now, many people would call that Republican or bootstraps. I'm not sure, because I don't think we're really talking about anything that's going to happen. But many people would say that. But is this idea that we're going to put money in Black checking accounts? Because if that's the idea, let's start saying so. And to be honest, yes, that would be a very hard sell politically. But the way to deal with it being a hard sell is not to couch it in all of this flowery language about who built the Capitol and slavery and redlining and Jim Crow and pretending we've never talked about it before and using an abstract word like wealth. If the idea is to send money into every Black, whatever that is, bank account in the country so that Black people have as much wealth as whites, say it. Put it forth. Let's have a real discussion and see where it goes. And frankly, I don't think it'll go anywhere, but let's do that faster.
Professor McWhorter, if I just may, wealth is not an abstract idea, though. I mean, it is very measurable. Go ahead, Professor.
Using that word.
Wealth is not abstract. It's fairly straightforward. It's the difference between the value of what you own and what you owe. It is a measure of the value of your property, your personal property, which is a resource that can offset losses in income.
Sure.
It's a resource that makes it possible for you to become a homeowner and acquire additional wealth. It's a resource that enables you to move into a high-quality neighborhood, a neighborhood that might actually have very good schools for your kids to attend. It gives you the capacity to leave bequests to subsequent generations. So it is a critical resource. It's a more important resource than income. And it's not something that's particularly abstract at all.
So what's your policy proposal?
I would go further. I would go further to say that I'm actually quite happy to hear John McWhorter make observations that suggest that reparations is something that is morally sound, but that most of his objections are on logistical grounds. I think that's another important reason why we should have the commission that has been proposed to try to address all of those logistical considerations. One of the logistical considerations that he emphasized is this notion about who would be eligible for reparations, because there would have to be some sort of Blackness litmus test. Well, in the work that I've done, there hasn't been any sort of Blackness litmus test as a basis for eligibility for reparations. There's been two criteria. An individual would have to demonstrate that they had at least one ancestor who was enslaved in the United States. And then the second condition would be for at least 10 years before the enactment of a reparations program, they would have to demonstrate that they had self-identified as Black, African American, colored, or Negro. So that there are really two conditions: an ancestor who was enslaved in the United States, and some demonstration that the individual had lived their lives in the United States as somebody who was Black identified. But there's no DNA test here. There's no external assessment of who is Black and who isn't.
Professor Darity, forgive me.
So the eligibility criteria can be handled.
You have to forgive me for interrupting, because out of respect for our callers who have been waiting for some of them 45 minutes, and we only have five minutes left here.
Don't want to block people off.
No apologies necessary from either of you, but I do just want to get at least one or two people in, okay? So let's go to Carl, who's calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Carl, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a few points to make very quickly. In 1944, my father served in the Navy. He could only be a steward. Less than 40 years later, I joined the Navy, served as an electronic technician, worked for two presidents. My daughter is in residency for neurosurgery. White America has done enough for Black people. It would only do more harm to the devices of this country. Blacks are doing more harm to themselves than ever before in time, but nobody ever talks about that Black-on-Black crime. And white America did elect a Black president. My statement is, how much more does America need to do for the African-American community. It's time for us to do it for ourselves. White America doesn't owe us anything else. We attained what we did by hard work and education. Putting money in folks' checking account will only destroy this country. I mean, I hear all the political rhetoric going around about reparations, but at this day and age, it is out there for everyone who wants legally to get. America doesn't owe us anything.
Carl, thank you so much for your call. Let's sneak one more in here if we can. Let's go to Jimmy, who's calling from Savannah, Georgia. Jimmy, we just got a little bit of time left, but go ahead and share your thought.
Yeah, I think, you know, reparations, if we're going to do it, it's a really a multicolored issue more than one ethnic group such as African Americans or Black Americans. You know, when you look at the 1800s, 1900s, where there would be job ads and it would say Irish need not apply here, or there would be job ads that would say whites would get paid X, African or Negroes at the time would get paid less, and then Chinese would get paid less, and Italians were at the bottom of the rung. And then, you know, you look at the West with the Chinese that built the railway system, you know, on their backs, the commerce from the East Coast to the West Coast was built on the backs of Chinese, but no one ever talks about that. So everything should be thrown out on the table, and we should put our cards face up and discuss everything for reparations.
Right. Well, Jimmy, thank you so much for your call there. John McWhorter and William Darity, we've just got 3 minutes left to go. But Professor McWhorter, let me turn back to you there. I mean, what do you we just happened to hear from two callers who seem to be saying that, well, I mean, Carl was saying he doesn't think that African-Americans require reparations at all. And then to the other caller's point that if we're going to do it, we have to open up our perspective on exactly who's deserving of them and have an honest conversation across races. Just your quick thought on that.
Yeah, Magna, I know we don't have much time, and I think Professor Darity will be particularly good on, you know, instructing those callers and maybe different perspectives they might have. But I want to say something in terms of my contribution here, just to make sure. I understand what wealth means within the context of this discussion. I'm not saying that the issue of disparities of wealth is itself some sort of abstraction. By no means. What I mean is the language that we use in talking about this, such that if we say there are wealth gaps, we don't immediately follow it with, therefore, we should pump money into the accounts of Black families across the United States. We should say what the proposal is. Don't just keep mentioning wealth disparities and saying wealth disparities over and over without saying what you really intend. I think our discussion should be very concrete and direct rather than genuflective and elusive, as if we're trying to soften the rest of America up for the real thing. Let's talk about the real thing now.
Professor Darity, we just got 2 minutes left. So, I mean, what would be a one of your real policies or real policy proposals now?
So one of the things that I will divulge from the book is that we're advocates of a portfolio for reparations, which is the development of a fund that could be used for multiple purposes, both for institution building purposes as well as purposes of neighborhood improvement, so that we can talk about addressing public wealth in the Black community. But also, we think it's important that there is a payment made to individual Black Americans for both substantive and symbolic reasons. And so there's going to be a multiplicity of uses of the funds, and that's something that can be fully resolved by the Commission's decisions. One other comment. My research center, the Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equity, has a major report that examines the causes of the racial wealth gap. It's called What We Get Wrong About Closing the Racial Wealth Gap. And with respect to the first caller, I'm very impressed by the accomplishments of his family. But this doesn't translate into the same outcomes for all Black Americans across the board. In fact, Black heads of households who have a college degree, who have produced the effort and motivation to have that type of academic achievement, have two-thirds of the net worth of white heads of household who never finished high school.
Right.
So effort, motivation is not adequate to close the racial wealth gap. We need something else.
Well, William Darity is a professor of public policy, African and African-American studies and economics at Duke University and director of Duke's Samuel Du Bois Cook Center on Social Equality. Professor Darity, thank you so very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
And John McWhorter, professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University and contributing editor at The Atlantic. Professor McWhorter, it was a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.